Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back Dr. Stephen Hooper. Welcome, Stephen. How are you?
I'm doing well. I hope you are.
I'm doing great, thanks. I'm excited about our show today because we're going to be talking with Dr. Mary Ellen Wells, someone whom you know well and is Director and Associate Professor of the Neurodiagnostics and Sleep Sciences in UNC's Department of Allied Health, about all things sleepy and awake.
Dr. Wells in our department is the sleep whisperer.
Well, that's what we should call her. But first off, though, we got some research that matters that I don't think we're going to whisper about, but we're going to talk about out loud because it's important. Our very first one is about such a common condition, osteoarthritis, degenerative joint disease. Most frequently, we probably talk about it in people's knees or hips when it gets so painful that actually they can't walk so well and they maybe get isolated socially.
And generally it occurs in older ages, but it can occur in a younger age as well.
And this is research that was published in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, a very prominent journal, about the European Project on Arthritis, and really looking at, does this social isolation occur more often with people as they start to form arthritis? And they really looked at people between the ages of 65 to 85 who live across Europe, over 2,000 people around the age of 73.
This study actually provides a really strong linkage of physical activity to mental health and emotional functioning, and in this instance, depression and social isolation. A lot of the folks were women in this study, and the fact of the matter is that the pain and the osteoarthritis itself actually was keeping these people inside.
Yeah, it was interesting. So at the start of the study, people who weren't socially isolated, 13% of them became socially isolated with, you know, within 12 to 18 months. So you know, that's a large number who are becoming isolated. They're actually, you know, no longer going out as much or at all. And they actually had osteoarthritis that got worse, more pain, as you said, less physically active. And so there's this really awareness now that having this osteoarthritis actually increases your risk of becoming socially isolated. I had known both those things in isolation. I hadn't really thought of them together. I think this is an important because it's not just, oh, I should, you know, some they're going to need a knee replacement at some point in time in the future. There's a whole host of years in between where social isolation may begin.
And the need for primary care providers to link to other allied health professionals such as physical therapy may actually be very helpful when not only improving the physical health, but also maybe having these folks become a little more connected and emotionally healthy.
Right. Physical activity and social activities. So the physical therapist, which we might think of, probably not enough, but not the occupational therapist that we probably, I can't tell you the last time I referred someone with osteoarthritis to an occupational therapist. Oops, my mistake.
Integrative care. It's where we're headed. And this would be a great example of how we proceed.
Well, our next research that matters is about physical activity, but it's in a place and space where it may not be obvious. And that's in the classroom with students while they're maybe learning something else. And I was like, oh, okay, so we're doing math and they're going to bring in physical activity, or world history, they're going to bring in physical activity. What's going on here?
This is a really interesting study and builds on a small number of other studies that have looked at the importance of physical activity, vigorous physical activity, to internal brain functions like dopamine generation. And in part, what's happening here is that physical activity is actually making people more alert.
Right. So in schools, in classrooms, you're going from one class to another, and you're going from one lecture to another or whatever, the type of learning, but you're sitting. And if you could increase some physical activity, would that actually improve concentration or improve whatever other outcomes are important to those kids within that classroom setting. And the short answer, looking over, this is called a meta-analysis, 42 different studies around the world in the British Journal of Sports Medicine publicizing, is the answer is yes.
And the fascinating part about this is most of these studies do include typically developing children. And you wonder, and the studies, other studies that this has been built on, have actually looked at children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, to the tune of vigorous physical activity actually functions in the same way as a stimulant medication.
Wow. Yeah. They talk about in the study that they did some things. Some of the experiments were like in children, let's say in world history, and they're asking questions about different countries, and the answers involve running. And maybe a country that's further away, you run a little quicker. But in place, there it sounds kind of funny, but it reminds me of sometimes when I'm giving a lecture and I'm after two other lectures and I've seen people in the audience just sitting for a while, I'll say, everyone, get up, stretch for a second, hop around, and you just see like people are so happy to get up and stretch and move around, and then you do that for a minute or two, and then you have them, you know, come back and sit, and it seems like the intention is better. I think that's probably what they're talking about with kids.
Absolutely, and the only other thing I'll mention here, Adam, is that what do we do with children in school when they're not getting their work done? We keep them in from recess. We keep them sort of in a sedate fashion, when in fact, what this study might suggest is we should be doing a little more on the physical end and not taking away those sorts of benefits that are perceived as leisure activities.
So all parents out there, take note. The mantra may be wrong. And speaking of mantras, this next research that matters is another mantra, which is when you have arthritis of the knee, a lot of doctors will say routinely, I'm guilty of this just as much, is you should consider, because it's before a knee replacement, maybe a steroid injection of your knee, that it can reduce the pain and increase the functioning. Now, I'm not certain I'm wrong, but someone is challenging this mantra in this research.
This study actually said that 8% of the individuals that got the steroid shots had various types of complications. And those complications included worsening of the condition, the breakdown of the cartilage in the joint, bone loss, and importantly for the immediacy of this, not a lot of pain relief.
Yeah, this was published in the journal Radiology, and it really suggests that there conversation between patients between benefits and risk really needs to be assessed. Now, we should say this was not a clinical trial, so we can't say that one was better than the other. And it was also people not just with knee arthritis, but also hip arthritis. We do know that the blood supply of the hip is particularly risky, and some injections can cause damage, and that's been well known. I was taught that early on, that when someone falls on their hip even, they can have these injuries of their hip that are much more serious and lose the blood supply. So I think that this raises questions more than it answers, but it raises good questions that maybe we should really look in more depth and be more shared decision-making about not just potential benefits, but potential risk of these injections.
Absolutely. And it also raises this important area of precision medicine. Who does respond in the most beneficial way to this and who does not?
Our last research that matters could be one of the most important we would have talked about on the show in a long time, but it's a big one. It's the inequality in the care that children get in different countries, and not just in different countries, but within different districts, different counties in, let's say, the United States, in the risk of dying before age 5. And it can vary up to 40-fold within different locations.
This speaks volumes with respect to the whole issue of access to care.
Social determinants of care, poverty, education, things that maybe help with access, but it's not just all about maybe medical care, that we need to reduce and really focus on reducing these disparities. And when we do, it sounds like that the health outcomes can be better.
And this study actually did show that over a span of about 17 years, there was a decline in children dying before their 5th birthday in terms of the numbers. Over that time period, But what was interesting about it is that the highest rates of death in 2017 were still largely concentrated where the rates of death were highest in the year 2000. So again, it speaks to those social determinants, as you mentioned, and in some respects, how resources are sort of dedicated to attacking a problem like this. Some areas of the world have made significant gains, and others have remained very, very stagnant in terms of their numbers.
Well, as we have bigger ways of looking at data, I think this type of data should go into resource allocation, where we put our resources, places that it may make the most impact. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. And when we return, we're going to have a conversation with Dr. Mary Ellen Wells, Director and Associate Professor of Neurodiagnostics and Sleep Sciences in the University of North Carolina's Department of Allied Health Sciences, about all things sleepy and awake. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Steve Hooper. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Steve Hooper. Today on the Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Mary Ellen Wells, Director and Associate Professor of Neurodiagnostics and Sleep Science in UNC's Department of Allied Health Sciences, about all things sleepy and awake.
Yeah, really excited, Dr. Wells, for you to be here with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, I think this is one of those topics that we could probably talk for a couple hours, because I would have all these questions. My patients would have all these questions, and we're going to get into a lot of that. But I think we want to know a little bit about you first. How did you get interested in doing research in a career that's dedicated to sleep issues and improving sleep issues for people?
Well, it's quite interesting. I got into the field when I was 19 years old, and I've been in the field ever since, going on 20 years now. And in the beginning, I was in undergrad. I did my degrees in computer science initially, and I started working with a neurologist and started learning more about sleep, and then decided that I wanted to learn more about how to do the testing, because essentially I was interested in being a human electrician. So kind of the other end of the scope of what the work I was doing in computer science. So that's really where it all started. And I became passionate about teaching and continued to go to school for my PhD and started teaching at the community college level. And then I got a call one day from UNC, and they were building a undergraduate program, and they were looking for someone to head up the program. So I took a risk and moved over to Chapel Hill and worked with Dr. Bradley Vaughn, who has been phenomenal in kickstarting everything with the program. And we built the world's first bachelor's degree in neurodiagnostics and sleep science. And it's a collaborative effort between UNC Charlotte and UNC Chapel Hill. And from there, we've had almost 100 graduates, and they're scattered throughout the country, and they're improving sleep medicine for everyone. And it's just to see the success and see sleep moving forward, it's just fascinating to me, because we spend a third of our lives sleeping, and there's still so little that we know about sleep. And that's really what keeps me driving on this.
The other thing I think about your background that's interesting is you talked about the electrician part of you when you were 19, 20. But you actually have your doctoral degree in curriculum development. So you're actually an expert in putting together curricula.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So it's in from NC State University, and I studied instructional technology, which is not just curriculum, but really putting curriculum online and people being able to do studies at a distance. So it's very unique, and it still brings in my computer science background, being able to do that and then incorporating the health piece in it, and then being able to reach students across the country wherever they are.
So let's take three different time periods in one's life. Take someone who's young, maybe 8, 9, 10 years old, someone who's out of school in their job market, they may or may not have a child, 20, 30 years old, and then someone who's like me, they're in the other stages of their career, they could be in their late 50s, early 60s. How is sleep different, or is it the same, as we think about when people really have problems with sleep? Because I guess if you're sleeping well, then they don't ever come to you.
No. So sleep is a little bit different in all the age groups. So with children, from infant up until young adolescence, the brain is changing so much, so rapidly, and sleep is changing with that. And there are so many important things that happen during sleep, such as the release of human growth hormone, which is so important for children and their growth and learning. So then as you move into adulthood, and then sleep really stabilizes. During sleep, you have what's called non-REM sleep, and then you have REM sleep, REM standing for rapid eye movement. And so we have basically three states of being. So we have awake, and then we have REM sleep, and then we have non-REM sleep. So those are our three. And then within non-REM sleep, it's broken into multiple stages that are from light to deep sleep. And through the night, we're going to cycle through those stages multiple times. About every 90 to 120 minutes, we're going to cycle through. And for, you know, a healthy, normal person, you're going to want to cycle through 4 to 6 times during the night. And interestingly, during the first part of the night, the cycles are going to change. During the first part of the night, you'll have more of your deep sleep. And then during the last third of the night, then you'll have more REM sleep. So there are nearly 100 recognized sleep disorders that we know of right now. And those sleep disorders affect people at many different times of their life. There are different disorders that affect people more when they're in adolescence, others when they're older. So it's really complicated and complex. And another interesting thing is that sleep crosses all disciplines. And so no matter what medical discipline it is, sleep is a part of it. And what's interesting is that sleep isn't covered like it should be in medical curriculum. So that's, you know, another passion of mine for education is to really trying to promote sleep education, because if we can improve sleep, we can improve overall health. Sleep is one of the key pillars of health, as even recognized more recently by the Centers for Disease Control. It's just as important as diet and exercise.
So with those three different age groups, what's the normal recommended amount of sleep when you're 8 to 13, someone who's in their 20 to 30, and then maybe someone who's 50 to 70? Because I imagine it changes over life, or maybe it doesn't.
So that is a question that I'm asked quite frequently. How much sleep do I need? And the answer is, it depends. It depends on the person. Everyone is a little bit different. Some people are long sleepers. Some people are short sleepers. And in many cases, it's genetically wired into us. So, for example, you may have a parent who's a short sleeper, and then that may mean that you're a short sleeper. And there are many other things that are involved in this. And so for young children, they need more sleep. Definitely need more sleep. And it can be from 10 hours to 12 hours, even more for some. And teenagers especially need their sleep.
So if they're getting 7 hours of sleep, that's a problem.
That is a problem. That is a big problem. You add that up over time, and just in a week's time, if they lose an hour, just an hour a night, that's a whole night of sleep that they've lost in a week. And you accumulate what's called sleep debt. And that debt needs to be paid for your overall health. As you're getting older, you know, it kind of stabilizes 7 to 9 hours. You know, 8 supposedly is the magic number, but that may not necessarily be true for every person, but that's what you want to strive for. And then as you get older, it doesn't mean that your need for sleep decreases, although many older people will report that they are getting a little bit less sleep, and that's due to a variety of reasons, pain and different types of issues.
Dr. Wells, what are the consequences of not getting enough sleep at the different ages? What will it do to us if we don't sleep and we don't sort of pay off the sleep debt?
Well, I'll start with a very scary example. Sleep is required for survival. And in studies of mice, when they were deprived of sleep for 2 weeks, the mice died. And that's similar to a death from starvation. So that's very scary when we think about that.
And in medical students, we know that we put in work hour reforms to essentially require people to have time off because they would go sometimes 48 hours without sleep. And we knew that that really harmed patients.
Absolutely.
We also have flight crews change. Pilots are required to get so much sleep before they even take controls of the plane. So the consequences, it sounds like it's coming in performance.
There are multiple
learning
consequences. There are some we still don't even understand. But yes, cognition is compromised, performance and memory and your physical endurance, all of those things are greatly compromised the less sleep that you get. And lack of sleep can actually look just like intoxication.
Right. And we have some evidence of that from the National Highway Safety data showing that a sleepy driver is as
just the same as a drunk
that's
driver.
Correct.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And billions and billions of dollars lost in productivity, performance in just America. And very importantly, there have been so many national disasters that actually they've traced to sleep problems, such as the Three Mile Island accident, the Challenger explosion. You can look through and you'll find documentation of either it happened in the wee hours of the morning or the person was functioning on way less sleep than they needed.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. And when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Mary Ellen Wells, Director and Associate Professor of Neurodiagnostics and Sleep Sciences in the University of North Carolina's Department of Allied Health Sciences about all things sleepy and awake. We'll be right back with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Stephen Hooper. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Dr. Mary Ellen Wells, Director and Associate Professor of Neurodiagnostic and Sleep Science in UNC's Department of Allied Health Sciences. And before the break, we had talked a little bit about sleep across the lifespan and some of the consequences if you don't get enough sleep at different ages. And I'm wondering, as we move into this next segment, if we should talk a little bit about what happens when sleep doesn't occur, and what might be some disorders of sleep that people might be thinking about or worried about? Top three, maybe?
Insomnia is the number one sleep disorder. Many people might think it's sleep apnea, but it's actually insomnia is the number one. And with insomnia, that's lack of sleep or not getting the full amount of sleep at night. And that comes in many forms. There are many, many, many things that cause insomnia, and that's where it gets complicated with trying to treat insomnia, is to try to figure out what is it that's causing the issue. Is it the person has somehow formed a negative association with their bedroom? That can happen. Perhaps it's clock watching or different things like that that can cause a person to be dealing with insomnia. And the second is going to be sleep disordered breathing, aka sleep apnea. And there are a couple of different types of sleep apnea. There's obstructive sleep apnea, where the airway basically collapses during the night. It can happen many, many, many times during every hour of sleep, and then your breathing pauses. So basically, you're stopping breathing during the night. And imagine what that's doing to our body, the consequences of our oxygen levels, the consequences on the stress on our heart and our blood vessels, and the stress on our brain. And really, sleep is a function of the brain, and that baffles a lot of people when they hear that, is that it truly is a function of the brain. Sleep apnea is certainly a silent killer, and many people don't realize they have sleep apnea, and they may not know until their bed partner is telling them, you need to go to see the doctor, because they see them gasping during the night. And the person has no idea that that's happening to them, because even though they're awaking during the night, it's not enough for them to be conscious of what's happening.
But they're tired in the morning.
Yeah, absolutely. And so consequences of sleep apnea during the day, it, you know, appears that they're fatigued and they're not feeling well, and a whole host of other diseases and disorders are associated with people that have sleep apnea, such as diabetes and obesity and heart disease.
And do you see snoring?
Often, yes. Snoring by itself doesn't necessarily mean that they have sleep apnea, but mostly people who have sleep apnea do snore.
Let's deal with insomnia, because as a primary care physician, I think you just described at least half my patients between insomnia and obstructive sleep apnea. And the pathways are different. Like, obstructive sleep apnea, in some respects, is an easier pathway as a primary care physician. You know, if you are overweight and you snore and you've got a elevated blood pressure, I can almost guarantee you got obstructive sleep apnea. And I know I can get a sleep study, but they're expensive. I know I can get you in perhaps to see someone who can titrate a machine to help you, but those are expensive. And so if you got good insurance and time's not an issue, we can do it. And that's the easier pathway. The harder one is actually the insomnia pathway. And that's because I get a call like I did today already from a patient saying, you know, I haven't slept in 2 weeks. I need Ambien. And if I don't get it, I'm going to go to the emergency room so they'll admit me so I can sleep for a couple days. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. First off, we got to talk about it. But yet, that's, again, a much more difficult in many respects because it's not just Ambien or nothing. There's got to be everything in between.
That's absolutely correct. And sleeping medications, that's another complicated topic. And there are other ways. And one in particular is cognitive behavioral therapy. And that is a key treatment for insomnia that's very beneficial for many, many people. And that's something that physicians can do, not just a sleep doctor.
When might you think about making that recommendation to a patient with insomnia?
For the cognitive
behavioral CBT,
therapy.
Yes.
Well, at any point. I mean, that's something that could be beneficial early on, you know, as soon as you see those types of issues.
So when we think about people who develop insomnia, who perhaps didn't have it before, to what extent is there some mental health stressor going on? And do we deal with that appropriately?
That's the complicated piece, is trying to understand where the sleep disorder comes into play. Is it the sleep disorder that's underlying this, or is it the mental health condition that's underlying this? Sleep issues and depression are certainly related, and there's much research out there that does link everything together. And so that's really key when trying to figure out which piece and how we need to go about treating that person.
So somebody comes in with that concern. How is it broken down? Where do you begin?
Yeah, I would love to hear your thoughts. You know, I have 15 minutes. These are small amounts of time to come up with a plan and implement the plan.
That's right. And there are sleep behavioral therapists, and that is certainly somewhere that a person can be referred to that would have the amount of time to really go through, because it does take a lot of questions with the patient to really understand what is going on with their lives to try to help them. So the behavioral sleep medicine therapist, those are people who can certainly help with that. Because yes, I mean, you know, jumping to the medication right in the beginning has all sorts of other effects that go along with it. So that wouldn't probably be the best place to start.
It just seems that while we know medicine can be very helpful for some in some situations, given the complexities of sleep that you've mentioned and the lifespan issues as the landscape of sleep changes as we age, it seems like that more comprehensive approach would be a healthier strategy in terms of trying to figure out whether medication or CBT or some other strategy might be right for an individual.
That's correct, because sleep medications typically you wouldn't want to use long term. So you really need to figure out what's underlying to come up with a good long term solution.
Let's talk in our last minute or two about the 2, 1, 3 areas that you're really focusing time, effort. You say 5 years from now, these would have been great 5 years if our research can do what?
Well, a couple of the studies that we have going on right now, we have a study that is looking at children with Down syndrome and their caregivers. And a lot of attention is not typically given to the caregiver, and that's really important. And that's not only for children with Down syndrome, that's for any caregiver of any child. And that's something that's really important to try to work with, is because if a parent isn't sleeping well, they can't parent well at all. So that's one of the key pieces. And then another key piece is sleep in women. And as a mother myself, we have a very strong at UNC group working with postpartum women. And sleep is a huge issue, postpartum sleep. And just like with the caregivers, if a mother cannot sleep well, then her infant is going to suffer. And so that's another really important piece that we're working on.
Adam, I got one more question.
Okay, you get to close this down.
One more question.
Naps?
Yes. Dr. Wells, tell us about the benefits and the detriments or the issues around naps. I love a good nap.
I like the thought of a good nap, but I never would do.
So the long and the short is naps can be beneficial and they can also be harmful. As I said before, we cycle through multiple stages of sleep at night, and we don't enter our first pattern of REM until about 90 minutes into sleep. So if you're going to nap, then keep it short. Because if you start to really cycle through, that's going to interrupt your pattern overnight.
Short as 20 minutes, 30 minutes?
You want to keep it under an hour. So gotcha. 20 minute, 30 minute, a shorter nap. The other piece is timing. With our circadian rhythm, which is driven by sunlight, and it goes up and down, and we have peaks and we have troughs. And one of our troughs is right after lunch. You get that sleepy feeling coming over, and that's one of the lows of our circadian rhythm. And we also have the other low at night when we're sleeping. And so with that said, taking a nap later in the afternoon after lunch, that is a timing problem. So that can also affect our sleep at night. And then, so if you're going to nap, keeping it short and then having it early in the day would be the best way to handle a nap. Any napping later on, then your nighttime sleep is going to suffer and you're going to have trouble going to sleep. And then that comes with another host of issues with sitting in the bed and clock watching. And all of those are contributors to insomnia in the long run.
I think the ideas that we've been talking about today are really important to our listeners. And on behalf of your health, I want to thank you for coming in, Dr. Mary Ellen Wells, to share your expertise, enthusiasm, research, and guidance.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Mary Ellen Wells, Director and Associate Professor of Neurodiagnostics and Sleep Science at the University of North Carolina's Department of Allied Health Sciences, about all things sleepy and awake. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking about your health questions and concerns. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Steve Hooper. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health for the House Call segment of our show today. Steve and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. If any listener wants us to address any question, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I've had pain in my side below my ribs on my right for years. It happens almost every day and lasts for about 1 to 2 hours. I don't take medicine, but it's still quite painful. It doesn't seem to be related to my diet, though I know I need to lose some weight. Do you have any thoughts?
Brings up one of the things that I a lot of times like to say, if it were easy to figure out, it would have probably been done already. You know, people have things that are sometimes difficult to figure out. You know, I assume perhaps this listener may have seen their doctor already, and, you know, common things would have probably already been checked out, like a gallbladder problem or like a liver problem. You know, you would think those are pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is pretty perplexing in the fact that it happens every day at the same time. I would wonder, just from a psychological perspective, what is happening during that part of the day for this individual.
Yeah, I think a longer discussion it needs to occur here, and really thinking about other things, ranging from some psychological things to sometimes you can get nerves that get irritated in the rib cage. I've heard of the runner's stitch that people get where they get a transient engorgement of the liver some things that change. Thinking outside the box a little bit, you know, musculoskeletal, other things other than like the organs involved. You can get, again, one of those nerves that goes underneath the ribs could get really irritated. And the people who can help with that are actually physical medicine and rehab a lot of times.
Absolutely. And the allied health folks could actually be looking at, especially if there's an adhesion of some kind.
Yeah, maybe a physical therapy consult just to see what someone else is thinking from a different perspective.
Right. And again, always good to go back to your family medicine or your primary care provider to talk about what else might I do here? Because this is a curious question that we've been asked.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing it up. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My friend has essentially no money and is more often than not homeless. She has severe pain and arthritis in her knees, but is recovering from alcohol abuse, so she can't take pain medication. What options does she have for treatment and pain relief?
Difficult issue. And it makes me think about, Steve, and I know you're aware, as a healthcare system, we're starting to think about not just individual diseases, individual organs, individual disciplines. We're thinking across disciplines, and we're thinking also about the social determinants of health, because we know a lot of things aren't just getting that knee treated. It's about transportation. It's about access to a social worker. It's access to a pharmacist, access to a physical therapist, things that could actually improve the function and the pain.
Absolutely. This individual is sort of a casebook study of a major societal problem that we have right now. The one thing that, just to play off what you were saying, let's say the knee gets fixed and the pain temporarily goes away, and you still have all of those other negative factors in that individual's life, it actually may not help with the rehabilitation of that knee. And it may actually make matters worse because now you have a complication on top of these negative factors that this person's experiencing. So those social determinants are really critical in a more integrative way of looking at this individual's needs. That would include the pain management would, I think, be very beneficial.
And then also things in society that most states are dealing with is Medicaid reform. Is this person on Medicaid? Charity care and healthcare systems to allow them to take care of people even without resources. Bigger questions than we can answer, but we can raise those questions. Thank you so much for sharing. What's our very last house call?
My wife has had liver disease due to obesity for many years now. She slowly seems to get worse every month, but sometimes she has a few days where she's back to how she used to be. At what point in time should I consider hospice?
Well, that's a question I'm not sure we can fully answer because we don't really have the information. But obviously you're starting to wonder, as she gets sicker, when is the treatments that you're doing not benefiting? Or, you know, is she falling a lot, for instance, and you're doing all the treatments that you can do. But I can tell you, you need lots of people's input on this.
This is clearly a team sport in this situation where the hospice is a very significant endpoint for many individuals. And you want to make sure you're there before you actually make that recommendation. And just from listening to the snippet that we got, it sounds like there's a lot that perhaps could be done, including some in-home health care that might actually begin to work on some of the other factors like obesity and diet and perhaps exercise.
Yeah, and you know, I remember, Laura, we had a conversation about the difference between palliative care and hospice care a few weeks ago. And this is a great example. Hospice care may not be the right choice right now, but palliative care could be a really good choice because it can help improve quality of life, which is really, I think, what everyone agree would be a good thing. Well, that'll conclude our house calls. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can send any question to yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, Dr. Mary Ellen Wells, and we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And Dr. Stephen Hooper.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.